And joining us on the phone is our first guest, Amanda Sturgeon. She is the CEO of the International Living Future Institute, and she's here to talk to us about what the International Living Future Institute does and its mission. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, you're welcome. Happy to be here.
Yeah, well, let's start with that idea of what is the mission or goals and objectives of the International Living Future Institute?
Yeah, well, we are a global nonprofit. We're based in Seattle, but we have staff and volunteers across the world. And we focus on creating a vision for the future of the built environment that allows all species to thrive. The built environment's responsible for a huge portion of the global climate change impact. We simply cannot address global climate change without shifting the building industry. It includes the manufacturing of the products that make up buildings, the transportation of those products, the operational energy that buildings consume, the water that they consume, the sewage that they send into our waterways and streams. They touch every one of us, and we visualize a future for the built environment that really allows buildings to be designed and built in harmony with the place that they are built in.
So along those lines, one of your key programs is the Living Building Challenge. So give us an overview of what that is.
Yeah, the Living Building Challenge lays out a vision for buildings to behave just like nature does. So buildings that would harvest their own energy and water, operate pollution and waste-free, and also contribute towards a socially equitable and just future. It goes beyond other popular green building standards to create models for the future for buildings that would create a positive impact in the world rather than consume more than they can give back.
When I hear, you know, a building that is pollution and waste-free and harvests it, all of its own energy, it sounds nearly impossible. but I know that it's been done. So tell us a little bit about, you know, where these buildings exist and how they're operating.
Yeah, when we started out, that was, everyone was like, that sounds impossible. And we really set out to show that these buildings were possible. We now have 100 of them certified and around 500 or so that are signed up to do the challenge. So we've certainly proved it's possible, but yes, it's a challenge for sure. Where our head office is in Seattle is at the Bullitt Center, which is a six-story urban scale office building that generates more energy than it consumes, that harvests its own water, treats its own waste on site, and operates really pollution-free. The buildings have scaled from all kinds of types. We have residences and homes. We have schools, higher education facilities, as well as buildings like the Bullitt Center. And they're scattered all across the U.S. in different climate zones, different types of locations.
We also talked about this term biophilic design in the intro. Can you expand on what that means?
Yeah, biophilic design, I mean, biophilia means love of life, mm-hmm. and it's the underlying design approach that allows living buildings to be possible. It's an approach that assumes that people are part of nature, not separate from it. If we design buildings with that approach, then we can create buildings that are designed to connect uniquely to their place, that are designed to take advantage, for example, of the climate of that place rather than fight against it, providing shade in hot climates, capturing the sun in cold climates, using regional materials that have a lower transportation impact, for example. So it's really about the design approach, biophilic design, that shifts our thinking to buildings are, you know, for people that are separating us from nature, versus buildings that are connecting us to nature and really thinking about the design of them in alliance with that approach of us being part of nature. So we're part of our community, we're part of our culture, we're part of our place and our climate. And we design with that approach, then our buildings will automatically use regional materials. They will be tied to that place. They will be you know, good temperatures in peak summer or winter conditions, dependent on where they're built. And And they'll look different depending on where they're built. Mm-hmm. You know, right now we have sort of the ubiquitous, you know, mirrored glass office building that is, you know, everywhere across the United States, no matter the climate or the regional materials palette. That wouldn't happen with a biophilic design approach. Buildings would look much more unique and connected to their place.
Right. I'm just thinking of more residential structures, like, say, back in the Northeast. We go back in time, log cabins using regionally sourced wood. Out Southwest, adobe-based structures. In Florida, you have homes that are maybe cypress or other pine, but they're off the ground to allow for air mass to pass underneath. And otherwise keep critters out, you know, out of the place too. That's regional aspects too. So you're looking at structures like that from through a regional lens of resources.
Exactly. Yes. And you know, you see that all through Europe or in other cultures as well. Yeah, buildings are really have historically been designed to really reflect that place and climate and region and the specific conditions of that place. But over the last 50 or so years, we've gotten, you know, sort of standardized construction. We've become more of a global building industry. You know, our buildings have become much more formulaic and not adapted to that place.
We're speaking with Amanda Sturgeon. She is the CEO of the International Living Future Institute. We're talking about some of the things about biophilic design and the Living Building Challenge. You also have something called the Living Community Challenge. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, after we were running the Living Building Challenge and we got past that place where we showed it was possible, especially at the scale of, you know, building like the Bullitt Center in Seattle, you know, we realized that we could take the same principles. The program's pretty simple. It's just 20 simple requirements. And we could take those same requirements to the community neighborhood scale. And we could think about how we could transform whole communities to be able to also act, you know, in the way that nature does. So, again, you know, operate pollution-free and harvest their own energy and water. And that program has been successful at really resonating with higher education campuses, for example, small neighborhoods, who are able to really think about how, you know, maybe one building uses more energy than another, one can harvest or share that energy, how buildings could maybe harvest water or treat water, you know, in really sort of an ecosystem approach, how they might be able to create urban agriculture opportunities for that community, and think about transportation that could operate pollution-free at that scale. So it's the same principles as the Living Building Challenge, but we, if you like, scaled it up to the neighborhood community scale.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the Bullitt Center that you've mentioned a few times. Tell us a little bit more about this project and how you got it off the ground and how it operates.
Yeah, well, the Bullitt Center really is, you know, impossible because of the Bullitt Foundation, who are the owner and, you know, main tenant. They're an incredible philanthropy that have supported so much of environmental conservation in the Cascadia region, Pacific Northwest. And they were looking to create a new headquarters, a building for themselves that they could then, as an investment, lease to other like-minded tenants. So we had worked together around our programs before, and they'd been a supporter of our programs, and it was really a partnership from the beginning to figure out, well, how could we take this concept to scale and really show it's possible? So, I mean, the building is commercially leased. It's a six-story office building. It has to, you know, be leased and meet the bottom line like any other building would. That's a, you know, commercial development building. We have composting toilets, for example, with a six-story office building.
What?
That surprises a lot of
people. Wow, yeah.
But they operate like any other toilet, and you go in, you wouldn't really notice any difference. There's no smell. The toilets operate with a low flush, foam flush, and then, you know, all of the waste can be reused as a nutrient source afterwards.
Mm-hmm. So are there requirements of, say, the tenants themselves to follow certain environmentally minded or ecologically minded practices? Do they kind of sign on to a change in their behavior?
Yes, the building has certainly attracted tenants that really resonate with the philosophy of the building and, you know, what we're trying to do with the program. But not everybody is, you know, necessarily, you know, I don't know, promoting the program or anything. There are regular businesses in the building as well. There are lease agreements with each tenant. So, for example, we have an energy budget, and if you go above that energy budget for your floor, then there's a financial penalty to pay. Mm. So far, though, the building has actually produced more energy than it's using, so that hasn't been an issue. But I think certainly through the lease, you know, tenants really need to sort of be aware of the energy they're consuming in a way that you may not be in a regular building, and really think about their behaviors in a different way. And that's, you know, part of the goal of our program is to push behavior and social change to think differently about what we expect from our buildings. Our passive sort of acceptance now in buildings is you go in, you sit down, and, you know, the temperature will just be delivered to you rather than you can open a window or you can get up and move around or interact with a building. So, you know, there is a lease agreement that's more specific than many buildings about the energy consumption in particular and different practices in the building.
When people are coming to, you know, visit the building, if it was my first time walking in, would it look or feel different than, you know, your conventional building? Would I know that it's this? Would I know that it's part of the Living Building Challenge? You know, does it seem any different?
Well, the most distinguishing feature from the outside is the very large solar roof that sort of projects over the sidewalk. And, you know, so certainly approaching the building, it looks different in terms of the solar array. But other than that, the building is really using existing technologies. It uses the triple glazed window system from Germany that's been around for quite a while. The composting toilet systems have really been around since the 1970s. The building, you know, really looks and operates like a regular building. So I think people are often surprised that it's really a lot of off-the-shelf components that are put together in one place versus, you know, something that is extremely high-tech, for example.
All right, so I'm a builder. I'm interested in this process. Where do I start? What does that look like from the design up?
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, biophilic design is a key principle to thinking about buildings differently. So really from the beginning, you know, the design team and the owner have to think about buildings differently to how we currently think about them. So, you know, buildings have become a commodity. They've become, you know, a status symbol, if you like. They're focused in on the programmatic needs of the building versus the community aspect, versus the experience for people, versus, you know, the impact those buildings might have on all other ecosystems. So the approach needs to be different from the very beginning. I mean, you really need to think about, I like to talk about it as creating a habitat for a human versus, you know, thinking about it as this is a people-centered place and, you know, nature is there to be dominated. And so I think the design approach has to start differently from the beginning. It has to be much more collaborative. Our program really does require a systems thinking approach. So you have to be thinking about the impacts on water, on toxics, on energy consumption, on the community, on equity, all at the same time. And that's very difficult for people because I think we tend to be specialized or we tend to think about one subject at a time. Mm-hmm. But you really have to have a sort of systems thinking approach to create a living building. And you have to work as a collaborative team and do that throughout the process. So that's the shift in thinking, I would say. And I think also the Living Building Challenge forces teams to think about some decisions earlier than they typically would. Like, what is the regional palette of materials? What is a palette of materials that would be toxic-free? And how can I now design with those materials versus creating a design and then finding the materials that are going to make your design work? So there's some shift in design practice that I think is pretty important from the very beginning. And often, frankly, you know, some of our requirements are not legal, for example. So it's not always legal to harvest rainwater. There may be some needs for the utility to address generating energy on site. And so I think design teams also have to think really proactively at the beginning about how they might have to shift some regulatory barriers to be able to do these types of buildings.
One of the aspects of community that you say buildings can impact is equity. And I'm curious to hear more about that. How does, you know, one home or one office building impact equity?
Yes, we have had some requirements in the Living Building Challenge around equity for a long time. And we've been sort of grappling, too, with, what impact can one building have? We require members of the design team to do a Just Label, which is a program that we run. And it's focused in on disclosing social equity criteria for their business, such as, gender pay equity, having health benefits for employees, really looking at racial diversity, for example. So we ask design teams to look through the Just Label and self-disclose how they, as a business, are doing from a social equity perspective. We also require that, there aren't sort of gated communities, that parts of nature or the environment are not blocked off from certain sectors of society, that, if you like, everybody is welcome, and that certain sectors of society aren't discriminated against being part of that community or that building. I think those sort of relatively small impacts have caused design and construction teams to just think about the role the built environment plays on excluding people, maybe their company plays on creating a more socially just working environment.
Do I need to hire an architect who is, let's say, ILFI certified, or can I hire one that can, understand the ILFI process through your design guides or other certifications?
Yeah, we're very much an open source program. Our program's free for anybody to download from our website.
Oh.
We have great, handbooks that describe it in detail. And we're a very iterative program organization. So, our project teams, as they go through the process, engage with us through a series of online dialogues or in-person conversations. Mm. So, definitely our goal is to expand the ecosystem of architects and designers that can have the Living Building Challenge in their back pocket as a design strategy. So we do provide a Living Future accreditation program for people to be able to educate themselves around our program, but you don't have to go through a certification to pick up the Living Building Challenge and use it in your project.
So for people who are interested in learning more, I know you have an upcoming conference, and there's also a new version of the Living Building Challenge that'll be released.
Yes. Our annual Living Future Conference is coming up in Seattle. It's April 30th through May 2nd, and it's a fantastic conference. We'll have Bill McKibben. We'll have President Mary Robinson, ex-Irish president, talking about global climate change. And, it's a fantastic event that really shakes up kind of innovative thinking about regenerative design and how we can create a living future for everybody. We are coming up to a release of the fourth version of the Living Building Challenge. We are very excited to be releasing it at the Living Future Conference. And the changes in the program will be focused around growing and deepening our social equity component to the program, really looking more at how we could scale the program at different regions, at different scales and types of buildings, and how we can continue to grow the number of living buildings that we see out there that are these sort of beacons of hope in their communities for what the future could look like.
And if I might add, there's a Living Future Symposium that's going to be here in Park City on March 27th at the Jim Santee, and we'll provide you some additional details on future shows. But that also will probably include some of the concepts of what the International Living Future Institute is all about.
That's right. That's part of Park City Municipal's My Sustainable Year.
Yes. And so, Amanda, last question. Where do people go to learn more about this entire process?
Yeah, our website is fantastic. It's got a lot of information. We also have online webinars that give you introductions to our programs. We provide case studies on our website, so you can go visit a local or regional building near you. And our conferences and events. So as you mentioned, the regional symposium, but our Living Future Conference, and we're always in a different city each week. So I also have a TED Talk that's just been released at the TEDMED platform around biophilic design, if you'd like to learn more about that. And I have a book called Creating Biophilic Buildings, which also has great case studies about biophilic design and can teach you more about what it is and what it looks like.
Perfect. Amanda Sturgeon, she is the CEO for the International Living Future Institute. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. That's really fascinating conversation.
Yeah, thanks very much. Love your program.
All right, thanks.